Welcome to A Tale of Two Cities, which is what this episode of London Futurist Podcast might be called. It's also the tale of two conferences and the tale of two industries, actually the tale of two mega industries and the tale of two possible disruptions. In a short while, we'll come to my part of this story, which is a conference I attended in Dublin, in Ireland, last week, the Longevity Summit Dublin. But let's start by hearing what Callum has been up to. Where in the world have you been, Callum?
Well, I was somewhere very hot. I was in Riyadh, and at 11 o'clock at night, it was like walking into a hairdryer. So I was attending the Global AI Summit at Riyadh, the second one, which was to discuss Saudi's Vision 2030, how it wants to transform itself. Saudi has traditionally a reputation of being a pretty fundamentalist place, and for good reason. It was, for a long time, since its foundation, it was a coalition between a hardline Islamic sect called the Wahhabi clerics and a large, sprawling and, shall we say, self-indulgent royal family. And this was sustainable until 9/11. And after that, it probably wasn't sustainable. King Salman decided that full reform was necessary. And interestingly, he chose his seventh son to be his successor, to be his crown prince. In Saudi, the monarchy is not automatically inherited by the eldest child or even the eldest son, but the king chooses his successor and nominates him crown prince. And that successor can be changed and has been. Anyway, King Salman chose Mohammed bin Salman, his seventh son, because he's a forthright, ambitious, and very direct individual. And Mohammed bin Salman went about reforming Saudi. So one of the huge things he did was to liberalize the position of women. So women can now drive cars. And while I was out there, I saw a female taxi driver. And a colleague of mine saw a woman berating her male subordinates, which certainly wouldn't have happened a few years ago. As well as liberating women, he moved the Wahhabis away from center stage and put out of action a group of people called the Mataawa, which is the religious police. These people went around beating in public anybody who they thought wasn't properly dressed or wasn't behaving properly. And they've disappeared. Nobody really knows what they're doing now, but they're not doing what they used to do. And he took on his own family, the royal family as well. There was a famous episode in 2017 when he rounded up around 200 people, mostly members of the royal family, but some other oligarchs as well, in what became known as the Shakedown. And they were interned in a palace, which had become the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. And they were told that they had all been stealing from the state and that they were to identify the stolen funds and return them. And they did. And there are different stories about how much coercion was applied to make that happen. So Mohammed bin Salman was on a course to reform Saudi very fast and in very impressive ways. And then came the Khashoggi affair, when agents of the Saudi government murdered a Saudi journalist who was a columnist, among other things, for the Washington Post, in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. And that, plus the prosecution of the war in Yemen, which has been a very brutal affair, has led to Saudi being shunned by many people in the West. Joe Biden, US president, famously wouldn't shake Mohammed bin Salman's hand, and in fact wouldn't meet him. He insisted that he would only meet the king, who is still alive. So what's been going on in Saudi has actually been missed by a lot of people in the West, but it is very impressive. And talking to people there, it's a self-selecting and smallish sample, but people were extremely happy with the changes, and they were utterly convinced that this genie is not going back into its bottle. The changes are permanent. The changes that MBS, as he's universally known, are prosecuting aren't just liberalising the country. He also wants to transform the economy. We're going to need oil and fossil fuels for a good few years yet despite the fact we are making good progress in the move towards renewables. But in the long run, obviously Saudi is going to have to rely on other things than oil and gas. And MBS is keen to transform the Saudi economy and to rely on other things. And one of the things that he wants to do is make artificial intelligence an important part of the Saudi economy. And Vision 2030 includes the goal of making Saudi one of the top 10 or 15 countries with regard to AI research and deployment. They've declined to put specific targets on that, either in terms of number of startups created, amount of money invested, papers written, citations of those papers, patents applied for or granted. But they want to become one of the top 10 or 15 countries. And it's a really interesting question as to whether they can do this. One of the dirty little secrets of the AI world is that cutting-edge AI development is actually a duopoly at the moment between America and China, and this isn't likely to change. I don't know the exact amount by any of those metrics, but probably between 80 and 90% of world AI development, leading-edge world AI development, happens in America or China. America's still significantly in the lead. China has caught up a lot. And then there's a big gap between the third countries, and I say countries because there's a gaggle of countries which claim to be in third place. The UK is one of them, Canada is another. But they are a long way behind. Now, Saudi has got a great deal of money. It's got a great deal of ambition. It hasn't got legacy systems, which people struggle to update, so it can leapfrog the West in many ways. And it's got a lot of top-down focused leadership. It's really quite remarkable that MBS himself is the chair of SDAIA, which is the Saudi Data and AI Agency. I don't think there's any other country in the world, certainly not other major country in the world, where the head of state is the head of the AI authority. They also have, obviously, some significant difficulties. Many cities in Saudi are not the most pleasant places to live, partly because they're so hot. You have to live indoors an awful lot of the time. And its reputation, both the long-standing reputation for fundamentalism and the really bad PR they've had around the Khashoggi and Yemen affairs. So they've got challenges, but they've got a lot of money and they've got a young population which is busy getting educated very fast and specifically educated in AI. It seems to me plausible that they could become one of the top 10 or 15 AI countries in the world. Maybe not by 2030, but maybe not long after that. It'll be very interesting to watch.
And what did they hope to achieve by this conference? And what do you think did happen at the conference that's worth noting?
I think they had a number of aims. One was to provide a forum in which Saudis and other people could meet and discuss ways that they can achieve Vision 2030. For instance, Sebastian Thrun, who is running a vertical takeoff, so VTOL electric flying car company, but he's also he's still the chairman of Udacity, which is a training company which spends quite a bit of its time training people in AI. He was there negotiating a very large deal to train Saudis in how to develop AI. So that they were there it was a forum for people to do deals and to discuss ways forward. And I think it was also intended to get the world to think about Saudi Arabia differently. And I think they struggled with that because of the major PR problem. The Western media wasn't there, as far as I could tell. And it was perhaps less well attended by leading AI figures than conferences in Dubai and other places that I've been to. But bit by bit, I imagine these conferences do have an effect, and I'm sure that was the intention, both to be a forum for ideas and deals, and also to improve the perceptions.
It sounds like you've had your ideas about Saudi Arabia at least slightly changed from your experience there.
Well, I have. Many years ago, I lived and worked in Dubai and very much enjoyed it. I mean, every country has its downsides, but Dubai was a great place to live and work. And Saudi was not a place I wanted to go from Dubai. It's changing. I think Saudi is on the way to becoming another Dubai. there are many things that could go wrong. It might not get there, but I think it's on the way.
As futurists, we should speculate on not just trends, but on intersections of trends. And Saudi's interest in AI could, in some ways, combine with some of the other things happening in that part of the world. So their desire to showcase smart cities, as never before, and also their desire, sometimes expressed, to go from being a giant in the oil industry to being a giant in the solar energy industry. Because after all, as you observed, there's lots of sun there. So is it possible that they could take on a distinct characteristic with possibly AI more closely involved with new cities or possibly involved with new rolling out of solar energy?
It is certainly possible. As I say, there's many things that could go wrong, but they've got the determination. They have resources. They're currently doing extremely well economically. I think they're the fastest growing of the top 20 countries in the world at the moment. And they've got a bonanza from the higher than usual oil price at the moment. They had the idea of building a new city. It's called Neom, and it features an extraordinary construction called the Line, which is a city built in a straight line from the coast inland, totally sort of new site. There's nothing there at the moment. And this city will be, I forget the numbers, but it's something like, it's very tall and it's mirrored on both sides and the top. And it's only a few hundred meters wide. And there'll be the fastest railway ever built. We'll take people from one end to the other. There'll be no private transport. It'll be all public transport. And everybody will have all the facilities that they need within 5 minutes of their front door. And along this great long straight line of mirrored glass, which I think is supposed to be 100 miles long, there'll be different regions and they'll be designed to be different, and that the hope is that they will organically become different. It'd be a remarkably striking thing if they do build it. And as I say, they have a lot of money and they have a lot of young people and they have the ambition.
There might be a connection with one of your own favourite topics, Callum, which is self-driving cars. After all, self-driving cars may progress more quickly in specially built areas rather than trying to coexist with pedestrians and human-driven cars in traditional cities.
Well, I think the idea for this one is that it would be just trains that would take you from place to place rather than having cars driving around. They don't intend to have private vehicles, and I don't think they intend to have small vehicles either. But, you know, they may change that as plans unfold.
Right. Shall we talk about Dublin as well?
Well, let's move on to Dublin, because in some ways this is a bigger event, not just for the world, but also for this podcast, because you are very much involved in this next one. So, yes, take us to Dublin.
So this was a three-day conference called the Longevity Summit Dublin, which I was very glad to attend. It was in a historic mansion house right in the centre of Dublin alongside the Lord Mayor's house, and the Lord Mayor did attend part of the event and gave out a couple of awards to people who had made some outstanding contributions to longevity. What was interesting is two more things. One we'll come to in a minute, which was the announcement of a new foundation, which I think is going to do breakthrough work in pioneering areas of longevity research. But there was also reports from lots of people from around the world. There were speakers from many countries, Singapore, Hong Kong, Ireland, of course, throughout Europe and America. And some of the talks were same old, but at least a dozen of them made me sit up in my seat at various times saying, wow, this is interesting. The world needs to know more about this. There is significant progress in another aspect of longevity, healthy aging. I might briefly just run through not a dozen, but maybe four of these talks, just as a quick teaser, and it's possible that we might invite some of the speakers to future episodes of this podcast. So I'll start with bats. That's these small, furry, flying animals, which have a bad press recently because, well, they had something to do with viruses that led to COVID and many other coronaviruses. There was a speaker from Dublin who had specialised for many years studying bats, and in particular why bats live so long. And I wasn't aware, but some bats can live up to 40 years, which is a very long, long time for a creature of that shape and size. And there are many, many species of bats, and this professor, her name is Emma Teeling, had lots of data about the ways in which bats have evolved ways to fend off the aging that applies to most other animals. So the goal there is that by studying in more detail the biological mechanisms of bats, we might have some insights as to how we can apply similar methods for us. A second talk I particularly liked was one described as parabiosis on steroids. Parabiosis is the name for when two animals are linked together with a shared blood flow, a bit like Siamese twins. So it might be a bit squeamish, but there have been some remarkable experiments over the years in which a young rat and an old rat have been sewn together surgically, exchanging blood and other fluids. And as a result of this interaction, the old rat has become in many ways younger. Afterwards, when the rat dies and its organs are examined, they have many of the characteristics of young animals rather than old ones. And what's going on here has been a matter of controversy. Is it that the young animal is sending some positive elements into the old animal through their shared blood? Or is it instead that the old animal's blood is being diluted and aging elements in that are being removed? And the evidence is accumulating that it's actually the latter of these mechanisms which is responsible for this apparent rejuvenation, that there are aging elements in our blood which we would be well to get rid of. And the talk by Alexandra Stolzing wasn't about connecting people together, but rather another method to take parts of the blood and the blood plasma out of our bodies, to identify the aging parts that are doing the damage, remove them, and then feed the rest of the blood and the plasma back into our bodies. Early days for this very promising research, but this is potentially significant. I also like to talk about using AI to accelerate understanding of drugs. Now, there are many companies who are doing this, and we might talk at some stage about Exscientia, which is a British company that's done great work here, and there's In Silico Medicine, headquartered in, I think, Hong Kong. But a talk I saw was by a smaller startup that claimed to be more nimble, more dynamic, and to be using even more recent elements of deep learning. We've spoken in previous podcasts about the idea that big machine learning can study large amounts of data, and the new models don't need much help from humans at all. In the past, humans would have to apply labels. They would have to give information, which should help the AI to work out what's going on. But, for example, in AlphaGo, when it won the game of Go, it was most successful when it didn't have any tuition from humans. It worked things out by itself. Many of the large language models, which we've talked about in recent episodes, have succeeded without humans having to label anything. The software just studies it by itself. Well, in a similar way, this speaker, whose name was Ivan De Weber from a startup called Cortex Discovery, was claiming that his system could look at lots of data about molecules without humans needing to do much sorting and assisting, and that it was able, therefore, to build a much richer model of how these molecules would interact with biological interactions. Oh, early days for that too, and I'm quite interested to get Ivan to come and speak to us and explain why he thinks he's got something more powerful than these other AI companies doing drug discovery. And the last of the four that I'll mention actually has an echo back to Saudi Arabia, because the speaker was representing Hevolution. Hevolution is a new fund backed with money from Saudi Arabia, backed with a lot of money from Saudi Arabia, potentially $1 billion to be spent each year for 20 years. and that makes people sit up. And the person who is running this, who reports to his chair, and the chair is Mohammed bin Salman, interestingly. And the CEO is a person called Mehmood Khan. And I think of all the talks I listened to in Dublin, his was the best. Best in terms of delivery. He was engaging, witty, provocative, and inspiring. Doing it all without any notes. And it's not surprising because he's been the CEO or executive vice president of many large companies in his time. He's in his 60s. He said that he could very easily just go and spend more time with his wife of 40 years. He didn't need any money, but he was so inspired by the possibilities of Hevolution. And what is that? Hevolution is going to be donating money to promising startups, promising initiatives in the longevity space. So you can imagine that people were paying very close attention to get any hints as to how they might get their hands on some of this potential $1 million per annum. It's early days with the company. They're still building their extended executive team. They're still working out their strategy. But it was very interesting to hear from Mehmood Khan that he believed the science was quite strong, the marketing vision was quite strong, but what was missing was the stuff in the middle, the actual products, or as he called it, the translation science, to take some of the ideas and do all the hard work, the incredibly hard work of building products that work in the face of lots of obstacles, the long time periods it tends to take for medical treatments to be validated and then brought to market. So he's very keen on speeding that up. And this fits with the idea of Aubrey de Grey himself, who we'll come to in a minute, who's always said what we need is engineering as much as science. Engineering says, well, here's what we understand already. How can we build it into a product? And how can we accelerate building the products? So I thought that was a very powerful talk, and I had the chance to compare notes with him about major disruptions. And we talked about the slow change in mobile phones and then the fast change in mobile phones. And we have a similar vision, the two of us, that we'll see the same thing with longevity treatments. And that brings me to Aubrey de Grey himself, who was the main sponsor of this event. Aubrey is a controversial figure, but also a very inspiring figure to many people. He has had different ideas to most of the gerontology community as to how to make progress in undoing the damage of aging. As I mentioned, he has an engineering approach, which says, let's not try and modify in too many ways the human metabolism. It's just too complicated. If we try to have genetic modifications, the likelihood is there will be side effects of these modifications. So rather, let's just focus on removing the damage that's accumulated through aging. And yes, there are natural mechanisms in our bodies which work well when we are young that deals with a lot of the damage. And so one of the approaches is to augment and extend these mechanisms. And there are other mechanisms, such as the method I referred to, the parabiosis on steroids, so-called, in which the damaged aspects of molecules or cells that are in our blood can be removed, perhaps. So Aubrey has gone through now three phases in his public career. He started off with something called the Methuselah Foundation, which is still very much alive. In about, I think it's about 2009, he created the SENS Research Foundation, which accumulated a lot more funds and applied many of his ideas in developing.
And David, SENS stands for Engineering Negligible Senescence, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly so. Strategies for Engineering Negligible Senescence. Senescence is the notion that as we accumulate more years in our life, we also accumulate more senescence, more zombie cells, more junk, more damage in the cells and between cells, and that makes us more likely to fall prone to diseases of aging. So, for example, cancer. We used to say to each other, if you don't want to catch cancer, don't smoke. But a more effective message would be, if you don't want to catch cancer, don't age. And that sounds stupid. But in a way, if we can undo aging, if we can undo this growth of damage, it will be much less likely that we'll get cancer, much less likely we'll get dementia, much less likely we'll have problems with our hearts, our lungs, our kidneys, suffer from diabetes, or indeed suffer from infectious diseases, or have problems when we fall down, which increasingly is the case when we are biologically aged. So Aubrey created the Sense Foundation, Research Foundation, which did great work and got into various, let's call them ruts. It was focusing on doing what it did very well. And Aubrey always is looking for the next thing, the things that are not being catered for by just venture capital and investment funds alone. So he has had for a number of years a desire to get into some new areas. And the Sense Research Foundation, whilst doing lots of remarkable good work and continuing to do lots of remarkable good work, was less interested in some of his newer ideas. And to cut a long story short, there was a power battle, there were accusations, there were stories that were exaggerated, there were genuine issues, personal conflicts, people getting hurt, and the board basically pushed Aubrey out of any position of influence, which annoyed greatly a lot of the donors.
Including me. I was a modest but long-standing donor to Sense. And when Aubrey was defenestrated, I stopped donating. So one of the things I'm very keen to hear from you about from this Aubrey 3.0 situation is what Sense donors like me should do next.
Well, I would advise you not to go ahead and donate lots more money to Sense Research Foundation until their future plans are clearer. What is happening is that many of the largest donors, the people who had obtained lots of money by shrewd or fortunate crypto investments, and Vitalik Buterin isn't one of the people in this group, but he famously, as the founder of Ethereum, donated a significant number of millions of dollars a year or two back to the Sense Research Foundation. And many other crypto millionaires followed in his footsteps. And they basically got involved in discussions behind the scenes, which are not public. There has been brief mention of them, but basically the result is this new foundation with the core vision of respecting donor intent. So if the donors say they want their funds to be directed by Aubrey, that's what it's going to be. And Aubrey has laid out in this conference in Dublin, and you can find some interviews, one of them by Phil Newnham from Longevity Technology. There's a 15-minute interview which Phil filmed with Aubrey in the final day of the conference, which sets out his vision again. And basically, there are a number of things which couldn't be done very well in the old Sense Foundation, which will be pursued now. And it includes this parabiosis on steroids. It includes campaigning in changing the minds of congressmen. There's an Alliance for Longevity Initiatives, which has been funded indirectly by Aubrey for the last year or so, along with other people. So there's going to be more of that. Public campaigns as well, through other initiatives. There's going to be new ideas in cryonics, which have not received much funding before. So this is another way of extending our chance for living much longer. And the final thing, which may receive the bulk of the funding initially, is something called robust mouse rejuvenation, which is not a new idea. It's an old idea, but it sort of got lost inside everything else. And the idea is that when there are sufficient treatments that we can find a normal, untreated middle-aged mouse and apply these treatments to it with the result that its remaining life expectancy is doubled. And when that happens, the world's going to suddenly wake out of its pro-death trance and say, my goodness, I'm a middle-aged person. I haven't lived particularly healthily. If similar combination of treatments could be given to me, maybe my remaining life expectancy could double. So there's been some interesting work in the past, but what's now going to be done via one of the startups that grew out of Sense, it's called iCore, which has quite a good track record with Senolytics and other investigations. It's going to be applying combinations of ideas from Aubrey's Sense Foundation to try and demonstrate this significant extension of healthy longevity inside mice. Why mice? Because they don't live very long. And they have, in many ways, some of the same aging characteristics as humans, not all by any means. But if we can do it with mice, the next step is to do it with dogs. And when people see their middle-aged dog living much longer, I think that's game over. And the world's going to wake up that rejuvenation technologies is possible. And they're going to demand of their politicians that more funds are allocated to accelerate this possibility.
Yes, I must admit, I think that it probably does need to get to pets and beyond mice. I think it's too easy for people to say, oh, well, that's just mice. They're so very different. But also, David, you've not told us the punchline of this particular story, because you're personally involved in this new initiative, this new Aubrey 3.0, aren't you?
Well, yes, I have been invited and I have accepted to serve on the board of the new foundation, which as yet hasn't been named. There's still some things happening behind the scenes before the details of the foundation can be shared more widely, but in the soft launch there were a number of us who are confirmed as sitting on the board of this new foundation, and one reason we have been selected is because we are all committed to respecting donor intent, not becoming conflicted with having possibly interest in particular companies or interest in particular projects. We are going to listen to what the donors say should happen. So there's myself and Gennady Stolyarov, who is a prominent US transhumanist who has spoken up publicly strongly in favor of supporting Aubrey's new initiative. There is a prominent campaigner in Russia called Daria Kalturia, who has helped to have aging established in some of the medical directories as not quite a fool disease, but as a medical condition against which drugs can be classified. So she's done very good work there in Russia, also a strong supporter of what Aubrey is doing. And there's two other people. There's Martin O'Dea, who was the main organizer of this conference, and there is the new executive chairman, who is Greg Grindberg, who runs another company, which is about advice for eating which kinds of food to help people with various diseases, such as diabetes, avoid the worst effect of these diseases.
Well,
I'm blanking on the name of Greg's company. I think it's Actual Food, so I'll have to check that out.
Okay. Well, I think congratulations and thanks to you, because this is an important venture, and it sounds to me like it's in very good hands. Very exciting future.
Well, we'll surely hear more about this aspect of longevity and other aspects of the very rich and varied longevity community in future episodes of London Futurist Podcast.
And I think that's a pretty good way to end it. So it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me. And watch out for new episodes coming soon.